This episode of Project I Am is titled Leading with Purpose, Dr. Rochelle Smith on Navigating Higher Education as a Woman of Color. Dr. Smith's story is a powerful and inspiring story. I hope that this conversation sheds light on the experiences of women of color in higher education and leadership, while also, hopefully, offering wisdom and encouragement for other fellow travelers along the way. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Please note that while I am a mental health professional and educator, this podcast and the information shared within it are intended solely for information, education, and entertainment purposes. The content discussed does not constitute therapy, counseling, or any form of professional mental health services. It should not be used as a substitute for therapy or personalized mental health treatment. If you are in need of support, please consult with a licensed therapist or appropriate healthcare professional. Hey, Rochelle, thank you so much for joining us today on Project I Am. It's really a joy to have you here. You and I have worked together for a bit, and that has been an absolute pleasure as we've been counterparts on the same team.
Yeah.
I started the interview by asking Dr. Smith to share a little bit about her journey, what drew her into higher education, and what inspired her to pursue leadership in this space. This is how she replied.
So that is a layered question, right? Because in some ways it's like a really simple, you know, I grew up in a family that, you know, our values are very simple. It was God first, family second, then business / education third, right? And the expectation was that you were going to honor God, you were going to be a contributing member of the family, and you were going to get your degree. Like, these were the expectations. What you were going to do with your degree was more of a nuanced preference, right? And so we had, you know, traditional paths in our family. You went to law school, or you became, you know, a K-12 teacher. Or you got like a very traditional, you know, government, you retire with a pension type of job. And those individuals in our family who did that, they were definitely the outliers in the data. It was typically law or education, K-12. And I tried the K-12 path. I really did. I gave it a good 4 years. I really was passionate about K-12 for about 4 years. And then I realized, like, I have students who I am counseling people more than I am teaching people. And I didn't know anything about counseling. You know, I found myself being a pseudo counselor more than I was actually being, you know, a teacher of social studies. And eventually I began to teach special education. And I found myself more drawn to their social needs and psychological needs than I was to their educational needs. And I was like, I don't think I'm doing folks any good as a teacher, but I didn't know another path. Thankfully in my undergrad, I had a good friend and I really think that God, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. You know, we've heard folks say that 1,000 times. And I really feel like at quintessential moments, he would drop people in my life, or cause me to revisit relationships. And I don't necessarily know why they were there or why I'm revisiting this particular dynamic. And then we move forward and it's like, oh, that's what that was for. So in a quintessential moment of my undergraduate career, he dropped this amazing woman in my life. Her name is Dr. Maria Gonzalez. And her whole path was, she had planned out her entire path. Like she knew she was going to do a master's in counseling. She knew she was going to do counselor education. She knew she was going to be a professor. And I was like, eh, I'm cool on all of that, you know. None of that sounds appealing. I really wanted to go into psychology, particularly experimental psychology.
Right.
I really loved the stats and I really loved, you know, I had fun in those classes. And I got a chance to be an undergraduate teacher assistant for an experimental psychology professor. And I was like, yeah, this is a path. But even this professor would say to me, and he didn't know that Maria and I were having a similar conversation. But even this professor would say to me, Rachelle, I know you're interested in this, but I think you need to check out the master's in counseling program on the other side of the campus. And I was like, I don't want to do counseling. Why do people keep talking to me about counseling? And lo and behold, I applied to the experimental psych program. I didn't get in. And I was like, fine, I'll go ahead and apply to the counseling program. And I did get in. The interesting thing about that is that this professor that I was going to mentor me, right, to be an experimental psychologist, I thought he was just trying to push me off to the counseling program. But in
Right.
all actuality, guess what? I showed up one day and he was in my class as a student.
Really?
Yeah, Dr. Paul Notaro. He wound up taking classes in the counseling program to
Isn't that interesting,
get his
man?
license. Yeah, so he wasn't, and it was. And as I look back on these moments, it's like, oh, wait, these were really like God-ordained moments. You know, this person over here and this person over here, not knowing that, you know, I was having similar conversations and they were really just like encouraging me to go in this direction. So that's I unwillingly went to counseling and I unexpectedly fell in love with everything about it. If that makes sense.
I was fascinated by Rochelle's story and was curious about what role her parents had played in influencing her and her choices.
I think when I told my parents about my career path, first when I talked to them about counseling, the whole family was very confused because there had never been, a mental health professional in our family. So they were, interested in, maybe you should have a backup plan, you know,
Right.
like that was their goal. But, they were supportive as long as, I was doing the right things and moving in the right direction. My mother is the oldest of 11 children.
Wow.
My grandfather, I tell people all the time, he was an amazing grandfather. He learned to be an amazing grandfather, probably because his oldest grandchild, me, was just very persistent and demanding. I remember I was a kid and I would call him. He owned a filling station, a gas station, and I used to fix cars there. And everybody in the family just kind of kept their distance from him. But I would call him up and I'd say, "Hey, can I speak to my grandpa?" And he would get on the phone and I would just waste time talking to him. I know he had money to make and he had cars to fix, and I would just like talk to him about his day. He was not, the best father, but he really was an amazing grandfather. We built our own type of relationship together. But because of his lack of presence in my mother and her siblings' life, my grandmother really had to tap into this, otherworldly, God-given strength, to take care of a family of 11. Of 11 kids, right? The one message other than God and family that she really drilled into them was you have to get your education. Because my grandmother was also the oldest of 11. I think it was 11 of them. Yeah, it was like 11 or 12 of them. And my grandmother was the oldest. And she saw the difference that education made in the lives of her younger siblings. And that they didn't have to struggle the way she was struggling. And she was really adamant about go to college, get your degree. It will make a difference. You don't want to depend on anybody. You just want it to be you and God if it comes down to it. And as a result, out of her 11 children, 10 of them went to college and got their bachelor's degree. Nine of the 10 that got a bachelor's degree went on and got a graduate or professional degree. And out of those who got a graduate or professional degree, we have my mother who got her EDS, her youngest sister who got her PhD, and four of her brothers are attorneys, right? So like this is like the educational background I came from. And then also on that side of the family, they're very much so like advocates, right? Like they believe in standing up and fighting for your rights because they spent a lot of time in Clarksville, Mississippi, where it was very much so a sundown segregated town. And that impacted them, and that impacted how they raised the next generation. My father's side of the family was the complete opposite of that. Like they love God. I am sure that they love God, but they were the if you know they were the yin to my family, my mother's yang.
I was fascinated by Rochelle's story, specifically how her mother and grandmother had influenced her to pursue higher education. But I wanted to understand more about how, as an African-American woman navigating academia, what sort of unique challenges she experienced along the way.
So I would like to say that, you know, yes, I'm African American woman, and I also want to acknowledge that there is diversity within the African American diaspora, right? So the challenges that I experience as someone who has a maternal lineage of, you know, folks who broke through quite a few academic barriers are going to be different, right? And then those who would be the first generation college student. And I feel like I can confidently say that not just because of the research, but also because, you know, my father's side, they were not the ones who went to college, right? And so I notice a distinct difference in how when folks on that side decided to go to college, their experiences were very different. And my father, he went to college for a couple of years on a football scholarship, but they treated him like a traditional athlete, so he didn't get the academic support that he needed. So when he stopped playing football due to epilepsy, he wound up dropping out because he didn't have the support around him to help him to really form a firm educational foundation there. So I want to acknowledge that these two worlds exist, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I had the, you know, family who was able to help me to navigate financial aid, who was able to help me to navigate if you're having a difficult time in a classroom. You know, I had that type of support system. What I would encourage folks who look like me and who have experienced many of the same things that I've experienced, you know, outside of that support system, create your own. You have to create a village. You have to surround yourself with people who are willing to speak life into you, who are willing to hold you accountable, who are willing to look at you and say, I don't understand why you're comfortable with the C in this class. I don't understand why you are not fighting for a scholarship. Better yet, let me just grab you by your hand and drag you up here to the financial aid office, right? Because this is what my mother did for me. You know, my mother, when it was time for me to go to college, my mother took me to the library and she sat me down in front of all of the scholarship books and she made me read through every scholarship book and apply to a ridiculous number of scholarships. I applied to scholarships for folks who were right-handed, you know, like the type of scholarships and I did not leave. I had to apply to a certain number of scholarships every day we went to the library. But I was blessed to have that mentor that was right there in the house with me to help me to really navigate that. And I know that that's not necessarily the case for other women, especially women of color, African American women. Something that we don't necessarily talk a lot about when it comes to being a Black woman in academia is that even though you have a PhD or you are on a PhD track, people still hold serious biases about what it means to be a Black woman, right? So when I show up in the fullness of my academic prowess, people often filter that through their biases of what it means to be a Black woman, right? What they think a Black woman is. So even this tone, this is just how I can, you know, I'm just talking, I'm communicating, right? I have had people be offended simply by my tone. Yeah. Yeah, I was in a conversation once with a white female colleague, and she said something I agreed with. And I said, you know what? Touche. Touche. Because I thought she made a good point. Her response was, touche, Rachel. Touche. What do you mean, touche? And I was like, oh my God, what is happening here? What is happening here? And I realized that she didn't hear agreement. She heard, okay, you got me this time, but you won't get me next time. You see what I'm saying? Like
Wow.
she heard it through a very different filter. And walking around, stereotype threat is something that I think that we as Black women, we really have to wrap our mind on around the fact that people hold stereotypes around what it means to be a Black woman. And we cannot expend our effort and our time trying to mitigate your stereotypes, right? And I would say that I spent the overwhelming majority of my career trying to mitigate people's stereotypes about me. I would smile more than I needed to smile. I would intentionally try to use a softer voice. There would be things that I wouldn't say. I would be looking at fires, like literally being set, and I could see the blaze. And I would just, sit there and just smile and nod because nobody else is seeing it. And if I say it, I'm just a crazy Black woman. So let me just not say anything because I'm trying to fight this stereotype. But what I've learned is that no matter how much effort I utilize to try to fight a stereotype, it's not internal to me, it's internal to that person. Therefore, it is inevitable. I can't be vanilla enough to make people comfortable. I cannot whitewash myself enough to make folks comfortable. I cannot code switch enough to make folks comfortable. I can't do it. I can try, I can attempt, and at the end of the day, as soon as I say the smallest thing, you're going to be, I knew it. There it is. I see it. And I've heard that so many times in my life, to the point where at my most recent position in my interview for my most recent role, I said to the end of, actually, no, it was before I got the promotion. Before I got the promotion, I said to the director, if you need somebody to code switch, it's not me. If you need somebody to agree with you for the sake of agreeing with you to make you feel good about yourself, it's not me. I speak truth and it's just going to be what it is. When I said that, I was 100% adamant that I would not get the job and I was at peace with not getting the job. But I said that after having over 2 decades of trying to be that person and still having issue after issue after issue after issue, never being accepted, being pushed away at the slightest mistake. So why pretend? Let me just be me. So stereotype threat, I think, is probably one of the biggest things that we as Black women have to contend with.
I want to pause here and explain that Black women in higher education often navigate this dual process of stereotype threat, which is the fear of confirming negative racial or gender stereotypes, and code switching, or altering their speech, behavior, or appearance to fit into predominantly white academic spaces. Now, these experiences can lead to anxiety, identity conflict, and emotional fatigue. While code switching may help gain acceptance, it often comes at the cost of authenticity and psychological well-being. And there's plenty of research on this by Blockett et al., McClooney et al., Steele and Aronson, right? But this dynamic highlights the urgent need for more inclusive institutional cultures that affirm rather than suppress diverse identities. What I love about the next part is that Dr. Smith goes on to explain how Black women in academia can mitigate this.
And I think that what mitigates stereotype threat is the acceptance of the fact that who you are, the power that you hold, the strength that you hold, the glory that you hold is wrapped in who God made you. Whoever that is, that's who you have to be. If they're going to come for you, let them come for your genuine self, because your power and your ability to withstand that lies in who you genuinely are.
This was so valuable for me to hear Dr. Smith share this, because there's so much truth in this, that your power and ability to withstand so many things lies in you being who you genuinely are.
Does that make
Man,
sense?
yes, I think I have goosebumps. As Dr. Smith shared, I started thinking about the amount of cognitive and emotional labor that this requires, the amount of energy that it takes, constantly managing how to present yourself while also striving for academic excellence means doing double the work just to be seen and heard. Thomas et al. Talks about this in a 2022 article called Two Worlds, One Body, Navigating Identity Stress and Survival in Academia. With this in mind, I continued the interview and asked Dr. Smith whether she ever questioned her belonging in these spaces, and if so, how did she manage to push through those doubts during those times?
So it's really interesting. You know, the very first full-time faculty position I had, that was when I was like questioning, like, do I belong in academia? Because I was not prepared for the level. Nobody talks to you about the level of politics that you have to deal with in academia, especially in a traditional brick and mortar school. You know, like it's in your face constantly and, you know, every day, all day long. And nobody really talks to you about that. And then having my first academic position in a city in which is regularly ranked. Actually, now they're doing a little bit better. I think last time I checked, they were number 7 in the nation. But at that time, they were regularly ranked between 1 and 2 for the most segregated cities.
Really?
Yeah. It was so bad that the particular campus that I worked at, I remember walking into the building and like the first year I was so puzzled because I could not understand why there were 2 women's bathrooms like right across from each other. I could not wrap my mind around like, why is there a woman's bathroom here and a woman's bathroom there? Like, I couldn't wrap my mind around it. Like, what is happening here? But then after some time, the cloud went away and the ignorance went away. And I was like, oh, this is from segregation. They never turned this bathroom over into a male bathroom. So like literally they had the whites only bathroom and the colors only bathroom, and they never changed it. So that was the institution that I was at. It was constantly in our face, even in the fact that there were over 100 and something faculty members, and I was the only full-time African-American faculty member there. It was well over 100.
And how long ago was this?
Like 2009.
I was curious about how Dr. Smith managed to endure teaching in that type of environment with these reminders of segregation all around her. This is how she responded.
I didn't know. I barely pushed through. Eventually, after 4 years, I went to a different university. There was no template in my PhD program on how to be a Black woman in an overtly racist system. Like no one talked to me about how to do that. And I was surrounded by it. I remember there was one point we were in a faculty meeting and a white woman walked up to me. And this is another professor. She walked up to me and she grabbed my hair and she was like, oh, it's so soft. And I was like, what is happening? What is happening? And the program, the department chair, she just like, you never do that. Like that was the most right. That was done. Like, you don't touch a Black woman's hair. That was the most that was said, right, in my defense. But there was nothing micro about it. It was a system of macro aggressions, right? How did I survive it? I eventually just left for my own sanity because there was nobody fighting with me or for me.
I wanted to know if Dr. Smith's experiences were different as she moved to other institutions and times changed and her academic career progressed.
I think the interesting thing about racism is that, or one of the interesting things about racism, if such a thing could be said, is that it has so many different versions, right? When I was growing up, I used to hear my mom talk about the different forms of segregation. She would talk about segregation du jour and segregation Gosh, I can't remember the other one. But one is like segregation by law, and then the other one is segregation by practice. She always used the Latin version of it because, she's a big nerd. So she had to show off a little bit. De jure segregation and de facto, that's it. De jure segregation and de facto segregation.
Segregation de jure, Latin for by law, refers to legal government-imposed segregation when laws explicitly require the separation of groups, often by race. An example of this are the Jim Crow laws in the United States South that mandated separate schools, buses, and public facilities for black and white people. Key idea is that it's segregation that's written into the law. Segregation de facto, Latin for in fact or in practice, refers to segregation that happens in reality, even if not mandated by law. It often results from historical patterns, social norms, economic disparities, or institutional practices. An example of this are the racially segregated neighborhoods today that lead to segregated schools, not because of law, but due to housing policies, income equality, and legacy discrimination. The key idea here is that it's segregation that exists because of systemic or social factors, and not legal ones.
And, she would use these words. And as a kid, you're hearing, your mom was like, oh, mom, whatever. You hear her talk about it, but then you start living it. And you're like, oh, this is de facto segregation. This is, we live in this type of city. Oh, and these practices of the institution, the systemic racism. Oh, this is de jure. You all have literally created laws, policies, practices within your institutions that allow for this to be, to exist. But the thing is, now, and this could be just my ignorance, my naivete, right? I do not believe that the majority of folks that I have worked with throughout my years actually had the awareness that they were perpetuating racism, sexism, that they had the awareness that they were perpetuating homophobia, ableism. I don't think that that was in the forefront of their minds. I think that they found themselves in a system that worked for the majority of the people. Therefore, the assumption was that the system worked.
At this point in the interview, I acknowledge to Rachel that as a white male in academia, I am totally unaware of these things. I hardly bump into them, and if I do, I don't recognize them. And I asked her, how can her white colleagues support black women in academia?
So I think my response might be a little bit, I don't know, confrontational is a word, but I think that somebody might give some pushback to this, but I'm going to say it anyway. So, in St. Louis, Missouri, around the death of Mike Brown, that gave birth to like Black Lives Matter, right? And I think that there was a lot of misunderstanding around Black Lives Matter and further investigation about, how funds are being used. That's them, but it does not negate the fact that Black Lives Matter. And I think what happened was Black folks and Brown folks and allies were saying Black Lives Matter too.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas white folks who did not understand that we were saying Black Lives Matter too, they heard Black Lives Matter only. Right. And in response to Black Lives Matter only, what they were believing we were saying was not Black lives, but all lives matter. Okay. All right. If all lives matter, then when I tell you there's a problem, believe me. Because my life matters too. Right? When I tell you that the way this system is set up causes me harm, believe me.
Yeah.
Because my life matters too. Right? So yell all lives matter, fine. But then sit down and literally listen to me because you do have blind spots.
Absolutely.
Listen to me and respect the fact that I am here to to fill in the gaps that you don't have filled. Because clearly you're missing something. If I am yelling that I am in pain and you're looking at me saying, no, you're not hurt, you're missing something, right? So if all lives matter, when I tell you I'm hurt, believe me, sit down at the table, recognize that I'm tired. And when I tell you what I need, you then go back into the space and you be that ally and you get me what I need because I'm burnt out. Does that make sense?
It does.
You know, today I was in the gym and this is Planet Fitness, and they have this no phone rule, right? But for whatever reason, there was this white woman, she was like a treadmill down for me, and she was on her phone. And I was like, well, since you're gonna talk this loud, I'm gonna listen, you know? And so I was listening to her conversation, and I fought the urge to just like jump off my treadmill and go, girl, what is going on? Because like literally, she was saying, are these people not watching the news? Are they not? Why are they acting as if a Nazi party doesn't exist? Why are they acting as if this stuff isn't like she was going full accomplice, not just ally, but 100% accomplice. And as she was going, I wanted to hear and I wanted to pay attention, but I put my headphones on and I allowed myself to be at peace because I was like, I don't know who she is, but I got a real ally right here. I don't need to worry about what she's dealing with because she has it. And she just looked at me and she was like, literally, I said, you good? And she said, I could never take these social studies classes that they're teaching today because I don't know what they're teaching, but it's not social studies. I said, you're right. And I put my headphones back on and I kept going. But that's what we need. We need folks who are willing to stand in front of us and get cut up and get beat up and get bruised up because I personally feel like I've been yelling into a tunnel since I've been in academia, and I wonder if anybody is actually listening.
I want to take this moment to distinguish between an ally and an accomplice. An ally is someone who supports marginalized communities, often through words, learning, and standing in solidarity. They might speak out against racism, attend diversity workshops, share educational resources, acknowledge their privilege. Key trait, allies are often supportive, but stay in relatively safe zones. Their involvement may be passive or performative if not followed by action that challenges systems of oppression. Now, that's an ally. This is an accomplice. An accomplice, on the other hand, is someone who takes risks and uses their privilege to actively disrupt and dismantle systems of oppression. They might do the following: challenge racist policies in their workplace, put their own comfort or safety on the line, collaborate with Black and Brown communities to push for systemic change, and take action with marginalized groups, not just for them. The key trait here is that accomplices are accountable to the communities they support and are willing to get uncomfortable and disrupt the status quo. In short, allies support change where accomplices make change happen. As activist and scholar Dr. Bettina Love puts it, allies stand beside you, accomplices are in the trenches with you. At this point in the interview, I pivoted and asked Dr. Smith to share her leadership philosophy and what some of the key ingredients are for building a truly inclusive and equitable community within a higher education institution.
My leadership philosophy, it really aligns with very succinctly with my counseling philosophy. I do believe that the people that I'm privileged to serve are the experts on what they need to be successful. So I really try to support the people on my team very much so individually based upon their own particular needs. And in that way, I am practicing equity and I am acknowledging diversity in those approaches. I'm also one who I think I stay in trouble more than most.
As I was listening to you, I was like, I can imagine you getting into trouble quite a bit.
Yeah, I think I stay in trouble more than most because I had a mentor years ago. Turns out we're like cousins. Found that out a few years
Wow.
ago. But his name is Dr. Lynn Beckwith. I wound up reporting to him before I got into like a truly academic position. I wound up reporting to him, and I got in trouble on my job for something. And he pulled me into the office, and he said, "Do you know why you got in trouble?" And I said, "No." He said, "Let me tell you. You got in trouble because you compromised your moral core. You never compromise your moral core. If you believe a thing to be true, and you are genuine about it, you do not step aside from what you believe to be true for the sake of others' comfort." And he told me that. Honestly, I would like to blame him for all the trouble that I've gotten in.
Would be nice.
Because he told me, "Don't compromise my moral core." So yeah, I think that at the heart of how I lead is this belief of I have to lead from a place of genuineness and a place of morality as I understand it to be. Because if I'm going to get in trouble, if I'm going to get in trouble, it's going to be good trouble, right? I'm not going to get in trouble because I tried to make you comfortable and it didn't work. Right. I'm going to get in trouble because I believed this thing. Therefore, I said this thing and I stand on this thing. And if you don't like it, then I'm in trouble. But I'm not in trouble because I didn't make you happy.
After going on a tangent and discussing violating one's moral code and all the negative things that happen to our mental health when we betray ourselves like that, I brought the interview back on track and mentioned that I had done some research on Dr. Smith and told her about something I'd found out where she had recently designed and implemented an inclusive excellence assessment. I asked her what inspired that project and what she'd learned from the process so far. You recently designed and implemented an inclusive excellence assessment. You, I mean, I did my research. Do you know what I'm talking about? The inclusive excellence assessment, right?
I did that a
Well,
while ago. Yeah.
what inspired that project, and what did you learn from that process?
Yeah, so Dr. William Cross, he was, or yeah, I think he just passed actually. And, so again, you have these conversations with great men and you're like, "Why did you say that?" And then you figure out, "Oh, that's why you said it." So he had created, he had written an article years ago, and it was called On Negrescence. On it was called the Theory of Negrescence, right? And it was psychology's first attempt to explain how Black identity is developed. When I looked at that theory, when I read that article, like for the fifth time, I didn't just see an individual identity development. I also could look in the article and I could see, oh, institutions have identity development that they go through as well, right? And in many ways, there is this interesting parallel between the stages that Dr. Cross described, as well as what you in people that you can also see in institutions and how they develop. And I wasn't the only one. Like, other researchers have also looked at his work and found some interesting applications for his research as well. So I wrote the article and I sent it to him because, again, I'm using your work. So I don't, I'm using your work and I need to make sure that it makes sense. And he read through it and he was like, "Excellent job, wonderful work." He said, "You should definitely submit it for publication." And then he signed it. I can't remember exactly verbatim, but it was like, basically, like, hold your head up because this is going to be a process. And he was right. Like, I could go into institutions and I can use the models, but the journals that I would reach out to, it would be a quick, like, no. And I think that when they looked at his research, they saw a, they when they looked at the article, they saw a clear line to the theory of negrescence. And I don't know if you've ever read, have you read that work?
But we teach crosses. When I teach a diversity class ever, which I have in previous institutions, we teach crosses, Negrescence model of Black racial identity development.
Yeah, so I think that I scared them. So because it can,
Again, you scared them.
I but you know, listen, if I'm gonna make you mad, it might as well be because I'm being my genuine, authentic self as
Right.
opposed to me feeling and making you happy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, institutions that I would go and consult with, they were very open to it. Different departments that would use the model at different universities. They were very open to it. They enjoyed it. They appreciated it. But yeah, I have to make it much. The issue is I need to whitewash it, and I don't have the capacity to whitewash my work.
Dr. Smith is not only a leader in higher education, but also a wife and a mother. I asked her how she balanced these roles, especially when leadership can be so demanding.
So I will tell you that I've gotten more comfortable in saying no as I have gotten older, right? And had more time in my professional identity. A younger wife, a younger mother, I struggled wholeheartedly to balance it. It was not uncommon or atypical for me to stay at work to 7 p.m. or 8 p.m., even though I had the kids and the family at home. COVID hit and the whole world was put on lockdown. And when COVID hit, it was the first time that I was able to see, like, oh wow, your absence does impact your family. Like, it impacts your children's development. It impacts the health of your marriage. I didn't realize it because I was so busy. We were all so busy, but then COVID made me sit down and pay attention to it. And when COVID happened, I realized I have to do something differently. And doing that, I realized that, when I went back to work, there were certain things that had to be put in place. Like, I had to be able to be in my home more. I had to be able to have a presence more with my family. I had to be able to go to the field trips and be the classroom mom and be able to show up at my husband's, trials if he, when he's, in court, and also be able to take care of me, because I also didn't realize how much I wasn't taking care of me. And saying no in academia is a no-no. I can honestly tell you that I'm about 95% sure that I have been quote unquote punished. Because I have said, no, I can't do this because I have a family obligation. No, I can't attend because I have a family obligation. But that's my moral core. God first, family second, then business, right? And to do that out of order is to idolize something above God and above those things that I value, and I'm not doing that.
That's huge. You mentioned your husband and you mentioned the trials, so you kind of opened the door. How has your partnership with your husband, who's also in public service, shaped your career and your ability to lead? And you and I have chatted before about my perception of you and your husband being this power couple. I think I once called you Michelle and Barack. In the high pressure careers that you are in, what's that dynamic like? How does that influence each other's choices? Basically, tell me more about that.
So we have learned to, and again, COVID did a lot to help us figure this out, right? We have had to learn to take a team approach with our career as opposed to I'm doing this and you're doing this, and then we'll see how this comes together, right? And it's a model that is constantly growing and constantly developing. For example, we've had to, and I know somebody else might listen to this and think, y'all are just now figuring this out. But yeah, when you have, two people who both value their careers, some things you have to figure out, you have to figure out along the way. One of the things that we've had to do is we've actually gained a closer walk with God. My husband, he wound up in the hospital, I would say, I think it was like all of the end of 2024, like the last month or two of 2024. And literally, I watched my husband almost die about three times. In that experience, we came out of 2024 saying, okay, we gotta figure this out because we've missed something. How did we get there? Let's figure out what we've missed. And we wound up finding a local church and we started attending the church. What we realized that we missed was that there were some key basic kingdom principles that we had invalidated because we had rested so much on our own ability, skills, and talent, right? So, for example, there were some areas of our life when it came to like success in career, it was okay, God got us a job and we'll keep the job. Whereas it was no, God got us a job, then we have to put our faith and trust in Him that He'll guide us through this process, right? And that one little principle wound up alleviating so much stress from our own minds. I don't know if you recall, but there was this point in our career where when we were working together, where I was like having panic attacks like
Yeah,
every day,
I
like
do remember.
every day, I felt like my heart was about to pop out of my chest. And I realized that like, okay, wait, these panic attacks are coming because I sincerely believe that this is all on me. Like there's something in me that believes that this is all on me. And I started praying more and leaning more on God, but it wasn't until after my husband went in the hospital where I was like, oh, guess what? I'm not just going to lean on you, get all of this. Like I can't do any of this. My son is having a difficult time finishing his homework. Guess what? He has a heavenly father. His earthly mother and earthly father are tapped out. You have to tap in and you have to do this. And it's been really interesting, like watching us this season of our life, watching us grow more spiritually and have less of an emphasis on what our professional identity needs to be and still having professional success. So it's been really interesting.
That's so much to juggle. I mean, you in high pressure careers and the kids and having a balance from a spiritual perspective. I'm thinking about, in an ancient sacred text, otherwise known as the Bible, talks about Moloch, right? And how people would sacrifice their children on the altar of Moloch, right? And I think nowadays, because of the pressure to be successful, specifically in the West and the way American culture works with the demand for so many hours of work increasing all the time, how it's so easy for us to sacrifice our children on the altar of our career.
It is. And I didn't realize I was doing that, you know. You know, I didn't realize until COVID hit, and it's so interesting that you use that phraseology because that was literally the awareness that I had. The awareness that I had was I was literally sacrificing my children, my family, my marriage, myself even for the sake of a career, right? And that can't be godlike.
And not good for your mental health, your physical
Yeah.
health, your nervous system goes awry.
None of it. None of
Thank you
it.
so much for sharing that. As we come closer, I could actually speak to you for another hour because there's so much that you're sharing that I want to dive more into. And out of all the questions I prepared, I think we covered maybe four. But as we start to come to an end, if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, maybe that young woman just starting out in graduate school, or advice that you would give to any part of yourself at any stage in your career, what would you tell her?
That's a really good question. Okay, so what I would tell her is this. I would say, hey, Rachel, remember growing up in the church and folks would tell you, stop talking to God about all your problems. He doesn't care about all of that. He has an entire planet to run. Remember when they would say that to you? They were lying and didn't know it. Talk to him about everything. Talk to him about the concerns you have with your job, your concerns with your grades, whether or not, the track team is the right team for you. Talk to him about the outfit you want to wear tomorrow. Talk to him about your health. Talk to him about your diet. Talk to him about your friends. Talk to him about everything. because he literally is concerned and has an answer for it all.
As we concluded the interview, I had one final question for Dr. Smith. Is there anything else that you would like to say to the women of color listening today who are working hard to make their mark in spaces that weren't always built for them?
Yeah. You are divinely, wonderfully, and beautifully made. If the space that you are in does not appreciate you, do not remain in that space. Go where you are appreciated.
Go where you're celebrated, not just tolerated.
There we go. I like that. Go where you are celebrated. Yes. Go where you are celebrated.
Hey, Rochelle, thank you so much for being here today. I so much appreciate you sharing so authentically and vulnerably. If somebody wanted to get hold of you, how would they get hold of you?
They can email me at RachelleDSmithSTL@gmail.com. That's RachelleD, then Dolores Smith, STL@gmail.com.
Excellent. I have learned so much. I am amazed at the depth of the experience you bring to the table that I have just not been aware of. And I feel a little bit robbed because there's all of the stuff about you that I can learn from that if it were not for some of the more personal conversations we've had or this interview, that I just wouldn't know. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was my interview with Dr. Rochelle Smith. She has a PhD in counselor education and she is a licensed professional counselor. I hope you enjoyed visiting with her as much as I did. Until next time, may you be well.
Today will be glorious. Put on your sunglasses, sunscreen, and sun smiles. You're gonna love it.